In the coming week, a new migrant caravan tests Mexico-U.S. ties. The Wuhan virus causes alarm and quarantine across China. And the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp is commemorated. It's January 23rd, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, migrant caravans leaving Central America have been a big issue in U.S. foreign policy in recent years. Last week, a migrant caravan left the northern Honduran city of San Pedro Sula, heading north to the United States. The caravan reached Guatemala's border with Mexico on Monday. Mexican authorities refused them entry into the country. When about 500 migrants tried to cross the border anyway, the Mexican National Guard fired tear gas and threw rocks to stop them from crossing. What is the status of the caravan today?
Well, first of all, Jim, it's a fluid story, and we should note it's believed to be the largest so-called caravan, meaning a collection of people traveling en masse, in about a year. There was one last year that ended up totaling about 8,000 people or so, got a great deal of attention. It was at one point termed an invasion by President Trump, and it stirred a whole bunch of new efforts by the U.S. to try to sort of stop these closer to the source. And so that's what this was about. This has now been estimated about 4,000 people in total who, I guess, originated in Honduras, transited Guatemala. It used to be a porous Mexican-Guatemalan border. It's not as porous anymore, although there are still, as we're seeing in these reports, there still seem to be places where these migrants can cross relatively easily. It's helped by the fact that there's a shallow river that has served as the border that they can just wade across.
And it has become less porous in recent years because the United States has put tremendous pressure on Mexico to stop the influx of migrants.
It's multiple things, but one of them has certainly been pressure on Mexico to take steps to stop such flows at its own borders. And so you have the Mexican National Guard waiting for these people. There have been several attempts, according to reports in the past several days, of people to cross various groups in the hundreds, as you noted, Jim. And they've been met by National Guard troops who've tried to keep it, you know, keep the violence level down. It's been more sort of a show of force to deter them. These groups are relatively well organized in that they've anointed spokespeople, and some of whom have read out letters addressed to the Mexican president requesting the transit of the country to the U.S. Why the U.S.? This has traditionally been the route of many of these people's family members. Certainly, they are aware of other Central Americans who've made it to the U.S. despite the repeated efforts by the Trump administration to try to rein in this flow.
They want to make asylum claims.
They want to make asylum claims. At root is the right that all these people who are in transit say they have to request asylum. The challenge is whether or not these are legitimate claims or not. They, in some cases, have sought to broaden some of the traditional asylum ground rules, you know, which has been the highest threshold of facing imminent threat to their well-being.
And I'll note that the city that the caravan originated in has for several years held the title of being the world's deadliest city, given its murder rate.
That's right.
And violent crime rate.
I mean, collectively, these caravans are, we should note, are from Central American, largely what's known as the Northern Triangle countries, which are plagued by violence. So it's El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala.
But there's also reason to believe a lot of these people joining the caravan are doing so for economic reasons.
Right. And so
and they're exploiting a loophole.
The Trump administration has pointed out is opportunism, and you can't dismiss that outright as well. Some of them have family members. According to interviews that have been done with them, because a number of reporters have now started to cover this and do in-person interviews, some were living illegally in the U.S. and were deported by the U.S. after living in these states for several years. They know there's work in the U.S. to be had if they can get there, and they know there's networks that they can join to do that and sort of
live. So it's a more complicated story than
you might guess
from reading the headlines.
It takes place in the context, though, of this effort by the Trump administration to really rein in this, what they see as this uncontrolled flow of people to the border, to try to get a hold of a situation they said has become out of control. They have responded in a very, it must be said, a heavy-handed way in terms of 2018 was a major threshold year for separating parents from children. That was in part a deterrent, and it's mixed about how much of a deterrent that really proved to be, even though there were thousands of cases of parents and children.
Well, given you have 4,000 more people headed north toward the border,
that's right.
It doesn't seem to have been a deterrent.
As we discussed, the Trump administration has been working with Mexico and has been pressuring Mexico, really, to do more about policing its own border, but also to serve as what they call a safe third country. So not that the U.S. is the ultimate place for asylum requesters to reside, but actually Mexico. So there's now an estimated 50,000 people have been told to wait for what could be up to months, really, Jim, for U.S. court dates to hear the determination of their cases. And it must be said also, the U.S. is facing a massive backlog in these cases. It doesn't have enough infrastructure, really, to just process these cases, whether it's judges, translators, people who can just sort of hear the requests and process the asylum requests. So they wait in Mexico. Mexico, in some cases, is offering asylum itself, is offering jobs. It doesn't seem like it's anything close to what is going to be needed to field the vast number of these people. There's also been an effort, again, it's a multi-part story, Jim, but not only are these violent countries these people are coming from, these are countries that don't have a lot of economic prospects on top of it all. In the case of Guatemala, for example, there has been a climate-induced problem caused that has hit the coffee industry. So you had these subsistence farmers.
Which may be triggered or spurred by climate change.
By climate change. On top of it all, these are among the most corrupt countries in the world. Now, corruption is not a cause for asylum necessarily, but it is when you look at the reasons why people, you know, take to the streets to flee their countries, their village, whatever, you look at these types of issues. So I think there's going to be, on top of the sort of blunt effort to stop these people at borders, is more renewed interest in the root causes of this, Jim, and trying to potentially set these countries on their feet. Critics of the Trump administration would say, you know, they've actually not stepped up that sort of support that
the U.S.
had.
Well, it's gone in the opposite direction.
Right.
I think critics would argue that the administration has made the situation worse in Central America by threatening or actually cutting off aid.
Cut off aid. They've also pressured now Guatemalan authorities are allowing asylum seekers to reside there, to seek even asylum there. There are efforts to do the same in Honduras and El Salvador, and there is some carrot and stick, but it's a lot of stick, it looks like, being used so far to get these countries to do so. What reports are indicating, whether it's this what's happening with this caravan and the back and forth across the Guatemala-Mexican border, or the situation around deportations, is a vast and growing gray area for asylum seekers. What are their rights under international or U.S. law? And you're seeing, again, in some cases, federal U.S. judges ruling against the Trump administration and forcing it to, you know, hear asylum cases, for example, or to reunite parents with children. There's all sorts of cases being brought by all sorts of groups, ACLU is just one, that are percolating through the U.S. courts. So it's a big test of the U.S. immigration system, the rule of law, as well as the administration itself struggling to get a handle on a flow situation that, as we see this week, is not ebbing in the least.
Yeah. I will note that international asylum law was not written with these situations in mind. I think there's a lot of work that can be done on that front. Actually, getting it done is a whole different question. Second thing I point, it's easy to talk about how we should address root causes or the push factor
right. In
the Northern Triangle, but the reality is everything we know about foreign aid is that that's actually hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't want anyone to suggest that somehow if you decide we're going to tackle root causes, that means you're going to eliminate this problem quickly. I mean, it's a whole interlocking set of complex issues. You talk about corruption, poor governance, economies that don't really work that well. So it's a real tough nut to crack.
One final thing I would add, Jim, is that the pull factor of the jobs that are available is a very real thing. It's been a through line in this story for decades, really. And you have the U.S. with 3.5% or thereabouts unemployment indicates there is still a demand for labor, especially unskilled labor. And what I would note is, in sort of looking through the materials for this podcast, I also noted an interesting fact about guest worker visas, which actually have grown quite a bit under the Trump administration. In fact, the number of guest worker visas has risen from 2010, I believe, in the last decade, it's quadrupled to over 400,000. It seems to be many of them are Mexicans. They're coming, they're working agricultural jobs and some other jobs that it's very hard to fill with Americans. And so that indicates that there are other ways you can possibly try to deal with this legally, but these other jobs are still there as well, Jim.
Well, that's why you often see cartoons that show somebody at the U.S. border holding up a sign saying no entry, along with a sign saying help wanted.
Right,
and that's
right.
The tension
and this is,
that has been going on
for
quite
a
long
time.
This is why,
for more than a generation, this is an enormous problem. Jim, let's turn our attention halfway around the globe to China, specifically the epicenter of a crisis, which is Wuhan, China. This is a city that's several hundred miles west of Shanghai. And I should note, you've just completed a podcast with our colleagues Tom Boyke and Yan Zhang Huang on this issue, so I recommend people listen to the president's inbox for more. But I want to get into what's happening now, even since you taped the podcast, Jim, which is further death toll figures being updated and the estimates of people who have been afflicted with this virus being updated, and disturbing parallels in some cases cases between this and what's called the severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, which killed many hundreds of people.
That was back in 2003 or so.
So, Jim, can you talk about what's been going on now with this Wuhan virus?
Certainly, Bob. But first, I want to tip a cap to you for flagging this issue last week, because it has really picked up steam over the last 7 days. And this is, as you mentioned about our last topic, a fluid situation. So what we say now could be out of date in 6 or 7 hours by the time this podcast.
Although what we know is happening is the Lunar New Year is beginning.
Lunar New Year begins on Saturday. You know, obviously in China, this is a major time of celebration. It's a major time for people to go home, to visit with relatives, to celebrate the start of a new year. And it is coming as the Wuhan virus has clearly taken root in the Hubei province of China. You mentioned Wuhan is the epicenter. Wuhan is about 500 miles west of Shanghai. And this is, as we sat down the tape, the current death toll is estimated at 17 people. There are more than 630 confirmed cases of the virus, though those numbers are, I think, guesses because this is a novel virus. It is what we call a coronavirus. It is related to the SARS virus you mentioned a moment ago that became a major issue back in 2003. Coronaviruses are a class of viruses, of which include, among other things, the virus that causes the common cold. This is a virus, the Wuhan virus, which is, we've established, can be passed from person to person. It's unclear how easily the infection can be passed. It's also not clear what its lethality is. It's always hard in these situations, particularly at the beginning, to get sense of how lethal it is.
Yeah, I mean, you say the common cold. We're here in January, and guess what? There are millions of people showing those symptoms.
And we're going to get back to that issue in a second. Obviously, the challenge you face in sort of understanding this disease is that some people may contract it and have what looks just simply like a common cold, so they're not counted in the statistics and what have you. But it's important to note that the virus has spread beyond mainland China. Cases have shown up in Macau and Hong Kong, which have a special status in the Chinese system. We've also seen cases show up in Japan, South Korea, Thailand, and the United States. Let me just caution people here. The numbers of cases outside of China are small. In the case of the United States, it was one American citizen who had been in Wuhan, had come back.
Who self-reported.
Self-reported because it was not feeling well, and that person is currently quarantined. Now, the remarkable thing about the 2003 SARS crisis is the extent to which the Chinese government tried to cover it up or retard the spread of information on what was going on. Beijing seems to have taken a very different view of this particular crisis. I will note that the Chinese government, Chinese scientists, have already done a gene sequencing of this particular virus. And that also attests to just how much medicine and science has evolved in the last couple of decades to be able to do a genome sequencing so quickly. In terms of trying to quarantine it, the Chinese government now has essentially put a quarantine around Wuhan. That came out yesterday, shutting down its transportation system, people not allowed to fly out of the city, drive into or out of the city. And just today, less than 24 hours later, the Chinese government extended that quarantine to 4 more cities. So right now in essentially central China, there are about 21 million people. It's about equivalent to the population of the great state of Florida, who they can move about their cities, but they can't leave them. And the question I think a lot of people have, is this going to be extended? Now, as you mentioned, the Lunar New Year kicks off on Saturday, time of big celebrations, but already in a number of Chinese cities, they've canceled their major celebrations. Anything that would bring masses of people together, because people, again, aren't sure about the extent to which or the ease with which this disease can be passed.
And as some have said, you know, it's like take cities the size of, say, Chicago, Boston, Detroit, maybe one or two others, and quarantine them at Thanksgiving. And you get a little bit of sense of how disruptive this is at this moment in time for China.
Again, what's hanging over this whole debate is we don't know how this disease is going to evolve. When I sat down with Tom Boyke, our colleague who works on global health here for the episode in the President's Inbox, he noted that the appearance of new viruses is not unusual, and most of them will die out pretty quickly and be forgotten. A few sort of become, I guess, robust and hang on, and no one knows with the Wuhan virus which direction it might go. And obviously, this not only has sort of social cultural significance because it inconveniences lots of Chinese as they're celebrating the biggest sort of holiday on their calendar, but it has potential for significant economic spillover after effects? Are you going to see travel restrictions being placed by other countries?
SARS affected the GDP of a number of Asian countries.
It certainly did. And I will note that this morning I received a China travel advisory from the U.S. State Department suggesting that we exercise increased caution about travel to Wuhan. This is a low-level advisory, but these advisories can be scaled up to the point of forbidding people from traveling. And of course, that gets you in the question of how goods are going to move and what have you. I will note that yesterday, an expert committee of the World Health Organization met in Geneva to discuss whether or not to declare this an international health emergency. The decision was made not to do so, or at least to postpone a decision. They're meeting again today, so this is a fluid situation. And I think a lot of people are trying to figure out, again, what is the likely path this virus may take? What sort of precautions? Is this going to be a disease that is relatively easily treatable once you actually know what it is and what to look for and can be contained through standard measures like washing your hands or wearing masks and what have you? Can there be a vaccine created for it or what have you? Or are you going to be in a situation where you have a virus that is mutating, which is hard to corral, so to speak?
Again, I would recommend if our audience wants more on this to listen to the podcast you did with Tom and Yan Zhang just this week. Among other things on the WHO front, it's interesting the discussion you had with them about how the WHO changed in its global watchdog role after the SARS epidemic. So China does seem to have somebody watching over its shoulder, and it remains to be seen how intrusive that watching is going to be.
Yeah, and two last points just to flag for this. One is that, and this came from the conversation yesterday on the podcast that I hadn't thought about, which is important, is that governments have to be careful about doing things like quarantines and checks, because what often happens is it drives people to find ways to evade. And you may actually end up making your problem worse because you drive the problem underground and people try to hide it. So that's, I think, the first step. I think the second thing is to be very interesting to watch how this plays in Chinese politics. We've talked a lot about the rise of Xi Jinping. He has made himself sort of the unquestioned leader of China. All expectations are that he's the one who makes decisions, that he's going to be around for a long time. There are great benefits to being Xi Jinping in that situation. There's also the real problem that when you have all the power, people will hold you accountable. It becomes a little bit harder. And so the question is, do we end up in a situation where this disease mutates, spreads? Does it affect the health of the Chinese economy in the sense that it takes an economy that's already slowing and because of, let's say, trade disruption, slows it down anymore? How does that play out? So there's real potential for in this situation. Not saying a high probability, but there's a real potential for this Wuhan virus to have much bigger ramifications. People are going to be watching out what's happening. Bob, let's switch topics and talk about a very somber anniversary, and that is this Monday, January 27th, marks the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi death camp Auschwitz. It's estimated that between 1.1 and 1.5 million people died at Auschwitz, 90% of whom were Jewish. Just this week, several heads of states traveled to Jerusalem for a gathering ahead of the anniversary. The event that will be most closely watched in Jerusalem will be an address from four of the main allied powers. There'll be speeches from Vice President Pence, President Putin, Prince Charles, and President Macron. So can you tell us a bit more about this historic anniversary?
Well, it's unfortunately being marred, Jim, by a very nasty dispute between Russia and Poland over history and, say, the rewriting or the reinterpreting of history and about World War II history, and not so much about the history of Auschwitz itself, although there are aspects involving the way the Holocaust unfolded in Poland. And Poland was heavily afflicted more than any other country, and Jews in Poland, as many as 3 million were killed in the Holocaust there. But first of all, the ceremony you mentioned in Jerusalem, the Polish President Andrzej Duda decided not to attend since he was not going to be allowed to speak to address the gathering there. There is going to be an event in Poland at the actual site of the death camp in the coming week. But the dispute is destined to carry on further. It gets to, I think, the debate that's ongoing in Poland itself from its illiberal government, its increasingly illiberal government, about the responsibility Poland itself had towards Jews and its role on protecting them or not. The government does make a valid case against Russia seeking to reinterpret history in terms of how it is portraying the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which was the pact between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union that sort of kept peace between them for a couple of years before the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union early in the World War II. And that pact also, by the way, involved the carving up of Poland and parts of Eastern Europe and so forth. It was Soviet forces that liberated this camp, and it was Soviet forces who suffered heavily in fighting the Nazis and who took on enormous responsibility for defeating the Nazi forces.
Well, you think of the epic battles of Leningrad, Stalingrad, the Battle of Kursk.
Yes.
I mean, the Soviets took incredibly heavy losses. 20 million Soviet citizens died during World War II.
Right. So this gets to very emotional material. It also spreads to what Soviets and later Russians, at least for a time, acknowledged was a massacre carried out by Soviets of foreign officers, 20,000 plus, the infamous Katyn Forest massacre. There has been new discussion about whether or not there was culpability or not for that. So again, it's this sort of revisionist history going on. It is a problem that has been part of Putin's Russia, really, for the last couple of decades, which is not owning up to its past. They've cracked down on a main NGO in Russia that had been looking into such issues called Memorial. And it's really in sharp contrast to a country like Germany. Let's not forget, Germany was the country that enacted these brutalities and the so-called Final Solution that killed 6 million Jews, that killed many other people seen as expendable or weaker links. Think of gypsies, think of handicapped people, and so forth. And Germany has taken painful steps to reconcile that history. I have lived in Germany in the 90s, and they were still grappling with it with some new museum exhibits about the role of the Wehrmacht in this, about the role of citizens in supporting the rise of Nazis and so forth. But they dealt with it. It was painful, and the Germans dealt with it and have dealt with it. The Russians have not. And so this is part of the problem here. But the Poles also have had a hard time grappling with this history. So you have on this anniversary, which really should be about, first of all, affirming never again to allow such a genocide to occur. Instead, you have this bickering over history and over owning up to the past.
Yeah. I think it's an important point, Bob. And I will note that most of the people listening to us chat here probably aren't going to have an opportunity to go to Auschwitz or maybe any of the other death camps, and there was more than one. But I do think whether you're in the United States, certainly in Europe, if you're in Israel, there are plenty of places to go to sort of contemplate just the enormity of what happened. There's a tendency to talk in numbers. You mentioned the 6 million and not grapple with the immediacy and reality of what happened. So I would just suggest anyone, for example, visiting Washington, D.C., to make sure you go to the U.S. Holocaust Museum to sort of confront and see what happened. I find it to be an emotionally moving experience because it tells you and it shows you the sort of the individual faces behind those 6 million and the real horror of what was perpetrated by Hitler's Germany.
I would just add the horror, the mania, but also what Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil, all of which both that Holocaust Museum that you mentioned and other sites also play up very effectively.
Yeah. The other thing I would just sort of flag for this, and what's really troubling for me, is that as we talk about the 75th anniversary, the liberation of Auschwitz, and liberation again of the other death camps and work camps by both Soviet and U.S. British forces, we are seeing a surge globally and also in the U.S. of anti-Semitic violence, anti-Semitic language, anti-Semitic behavior. And it's deeply troubling to see this. And again, we talk about countries having learned. You mentioned the Germans have learned. I think that actually for a lot of us in a lot of countries, a lot of these lessons need to be relearned. And maybe it is a matter of learning and continuing to learn. It's not,
I think
the history's not dead because we still deal with those demons. And it's not simply what happened to Jews in World War II or the other people who were deemed undesirable by Hitler. But we look across the world today and we see the same behaviors being perpetrated over and over again, sort of the extent to which human beings can be inhumane to other human beings.
No, it's a very good point, Jim. I would just add to that, it's that combination of that inhumanity. And then it's the subversion of truth or the distortion.
That's an important point.
And again, whether it has to do with the Holocaust, and there is a whole industry of Holocaust deniers out there, or you get to what has happened. We just had a ruling from the International Court of Justice today on what the Myanmar regime perpetrated against Rohingya.
I'm glad you raised it because I was where I was going to go.
And yet, you know, that violence against Rohingya was whipped up by a frenzy of misinformation and hate speech and so forth. And it happens again and again. And then there's denial. There is subversion of truth. And it's happening across the board. And as we're seeing the reinterpretation of World War II history, history is there. It is out there. It has been exhaustively reported. And it needs to be, as you said, Jim, that history needs to be taught and sort of reinforced in a way where these mistruths and alternate versions of history can just be stamped out at the outset. Well, this is the time for the Figures of the Week portion of the podcast, Jim. We'll kick off with our Twitter poll. And our Twitter poll is a number figure. It is actually 3,737 tons of trash returned. Jim, why did our audience select this figure?
Our audience selected this figure, Bob, because just this week, the government of Malaysia announced it was ordering the return of the 3,737 metric tons of trash to 13 countries. Now, this gets us into the bigger issue of recycling of plastic. We see a lot of talk about the need to gather up plastic and recycle it. For many years, what happened was a lot of that recycled plastic was sent to China. The Chinese saw profit in doing so. And in 2018, the Chinese government decided that that business of recycling was actually harmful to its own economy and ecology, and the Chinese cracked down on it. Now, all of a sudden, you have countries looking to find some place to send their plastic to be recycled. A lot of it has gone to Malaysia, and the Malaysian government concluded that this was harmful to Malaysia and the Malaysian economy. Something on the order of 150 containers full of recycled plastic and other things were sent back to countries. 43 containers went to France, 42 to the United Kingdom.
I guess so. Let me get this right. These are big container ships floating around just filled with trash?
Just filled with trash and looking to recycle. And I think this gets us back to a question we have here in the United States and elsewhere. We talk a lot about recycling. We have campaigns to recycle. Make sure you throw your recyclable bottle in the recycling bin so it can get recycled. And we think somehow that everything gets recycled. And a lot of this plastic doesn't, in fact, get recycled. Wonderful podcast done by our sister podcast,
Why It Matters.
Why It Matters. I guess we did it back in November, and they titled it China Doesn't Want Your Trash, which explains a lot of this. But the fact is, we produce huge amounts of plastic, and much of it can be recycled. Much of it isn't recycled. Much of it, which is intended to be recycled, ends up getting shipped overseas where it doesn't get recycled.
Yeah, and it turns out it's, as that podcast and other great reporting has shown, there was this wishful thinking that, hey, we've identified a problem, we're going to be virtuous and throw our multiple plastic containers in a bin and it's going to go away. But those multiple containers are all different sorts of plastic for one thing. It's plastic shampoo containers with half filled with shampoo or some other sort of packaging that is very difficult to unpack, yeah, or to unwind and to convert back into plastic. There's a whole host of things that need to happen. And I think it starts with, in my own community in Virginia is dealing with this now, is the generation of the waste to begin with.
Right.
Do you need all this packaging? And Americans, by far, and anywhere you go in the world, the amount of packaging Americans have for the smallest product is overwhelming.
The reliance on plastics has exploded, certainly over the last couple of decades. You note this about our packaging here. And in many ways, our new modern digital economy, where you get goods on delivery, just log into Amazon, and you say, send it to me, has actually made the problem worse on the packaging. And we talk a lot about reduce, reuse, recycle. And I think recycle is the weakest of those three legs for precisely the reason we talk about. But it can be really hard to reduce. I mean, one of the things I've been trying to do for the last year or so is to reduce my use of plastic, particularly one-time plastics. But they're, like, in at least in American society, an integral part of your day-to-day life, right? You go, even if you want to get a soda at a Subway or any other fast food joint, and it comes with the straw, which is plastic, and the lid that is plastic, which gets used once and is disposed. You get on a plane and maybe they give you a plastic bottle of water and it just gets multiplied over and over again. You get plastic utensils. I think it's a real question we have to face. Can we continue to generate this kind of waste stream? And I think the answer is we can't. Now, some people hold out technological solutions as our great hope. I know there's work done at a variety of universities. I think University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign is doing a lot of work trying to find plastics that are very easily recyclable.
And you're seeing things like everything from outdoor decks to playgrounds and other things created from recycled materials, right, that are both durable, safe, and have the ultimate feel-good sense of being a recycler.
Right. And we get things like here in D.C., if you want a plastic bag at the grocery store, you have to pay for it. So that encourages people to bring their own cloth bags. I think all that is good. It's just not clear to me that it is sufficient, yeah, to just the amount of plastic we generate. Go to a sporting event. Was it a football game? University of Michigan, stadium of 100,000 people. When the game's over and you're walking out, all those plastic cups used once.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a real problem. I think we're really going to have to grapple with our addiction to plastic. But enough of my being on my soapbox, Bob. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Well, I'm going to add another grim figure to the list this week, Jim. It's a number. It's 100, as in 100 seconds to midnight. That is the new calculation, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the publication that's been doing this sort of rating since 1947, has assessed. They've just refined their iconic minutes to midnight estimate by creating seconds. This 100 seconds to midnight rating raises the threat of nuclear war closer than it ever has been to a possibility. And they cite many reasons, including the ongoing deadlock of UN disarmament talks, the ramping up of North Korean capabilities, the crumbling of the Iran nuclear deal, the general sense of the international community's lack of commitment to nuclear disarmament and safeguards that had been building in momentum towards the end of the 20th century, and that clock had been ticking a little bit into a safer zone. There is this collective sense that there's not being enough done, the sort of trend lines in the world towards arming up again, and the lack of custodians such as the U.S. in doing more to safeguard the regime, the nuclear regime, has raising this concern. So, as I said, it's an iconic thing. It's a gimmick, certainly, but it is created by a number of people who follow this issue very closely, who have worked in this field, in government, in academia, and so forth. It's one of these moments that is supposed to give you pause and think about where things are going.
And it's worth taking pause. One of the consequences of having greater geopolitical conflict, greater geopolitical competition, again, that's the point of the U.S. national security strategy, is that this very issue of nuclear competition moves up the priority list. It becomes more likely. But it's also, as you point out, because efforts to prevent nuclear proliferation aren't working in all cases. North Korea, obviously, also with Iran. So that's reason to be concerned. And again, finally, because of choices made by the Russians, but particularly also made by the United States, we are seeing the end of that arms control regime that was built up beginning in the late 60s and reaching into the first decade of this century. And in some sense, as I watch sort of the nuclear debate, I'm sort of struck that arguments that were made and one would have thought put to bed round about the mid-1980s are now coming up. Can we use nuclear weapons to fight and win a war? Should we design new weapons may blur the boundary between conventional force and nuclear force? And of course, then there is the issue that's always hung over this. We're moving into a bigger question about is rely more and more on automation, on complicated systems of defense and detection. Are we creating whole new sets of vulnerabilities for ourselves? I think these are very big issues to work through.
Well, Jim, who or what is your figure of the week?
My figure of the week is a person, and I am going with Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He is in the news this week because two UN human rights investigators have argued that an investigation should be opened up into his possible involvement in hacking the phone of Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world and also the owner of the Washington Post. It's actually a fascinating story, and the Washington Post, not surprisingly, has a lot on its website about it. Apparently, in April 2018, Crown Prince Salman, better known as MBS by his initials, met Bezos at a dinner party in Hollywood. They exchanged information, exchanged text, and that connection was then used by someone in Saudi Arabia to plant what appears to be malicious code on Jeff Bezos' phone.
It was a WhatsApp connection, I believe.
WhatsApp connection, and they were able to, this is the word people in this community like to use, exfiltrate all kinds of information off of Bezos's phone. Now, obviously, this has a broader context, which is the Washington Post ran the work by Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian dissident columnist. And of course, it was on the pages of the Post that Khashoggi criticized the Saudi government. Of course, Khashoggi was then murdered in Istanbul.
In the fall of 2018. Yeah.
Fall of 2018. So there's very interesting things going on here. Lessons both for or the vulnerability everyone has in terms of their phone in being hacked, but also what the government of Saudi Arabia has been up to.
So you're right, it is a fascinating case. It remains to be seen what, if any, this flagging by the UN will lead to, because the UN was very outspoken in its own investigation into Khashoggi killing that the responsibility clearly was the Crown Prince's, and yet we're not seeing anything else happen. For things to happen at the UN in an effective way, you need the Security Council states, especially the veto-wielding ones, to move to guide activities, and that's not happening. The Trump administration is fairly strongly supported MBS. Well, that's our look at the roiling world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Peru holds parliamentary elections, and the martyrdom anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi is marked.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Special thanks go out to Anu Kumar, Claire McGraw, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Anthony LeBerry. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long.